Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Ugh, fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
This is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Tom Joslin, the senior fellow for the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He and his colleague Bill Raggio and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal. The story so far of the vast Ummah, the canvas between the Mediterranean and the Hindu Kush, battling with radical and destructive elements, one of which is the Taliban, most recently in the news because of the U.S. and NATO withdrawal from Afghanistan. However, also most recently, Tom testified in Washington, an ordeal for anyone. I've never done it, but I've watched it enough to know the preparation is everything. Tom testified to two different committees. I'm interested most, armed forces and banking. I'm interested mostly right now in his testimony to banking, because in Generation Jihad, the podcast that Tom and Bill produced for us on the Long War Journal site, there was lengthy discussion about different senators asking different questions of Tom about what is to be done, what happens now. We can see the retreat in Kabul and the fall of the Afghan government over these last months. But what is in front of us is fog of war. So I begin with welcoming Tom, and Tom and I have discussed how we will acknowledge the loss of Colin Powell, a very sturdy representative of both the U.S. Army and the U.S. State Department for many years. The news is unhappy for anyone's death, but especially because Colin Powell, the report is, has succumbed to COVID-19, the virus. Tom, your thoughts about losing Colin Powell. He was there at the beginning of the Afghan conflict, and right now he's left us at what you'd say is a turning point. You make a wonderful wit about that, Tom, but a turning point in the Afghan conflict for what happens next. What do you remember about Colin Powell, Tom, early on in your reporting?
Well, you know, John, I think Colin Powell obviously was involved at the very beginning of the war in Afghanistan. And I always think back to this list of demands that he and his right-hand guy at the time, Dick Armitage at the State Department, delivered to the Pakistani state immediately following 9/11. There were a whole series of demands that the American government placed on the Pakistanis, including, you know, reining in the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and various aspects of it. And when you go back and revisit that list, there's 10, 11, something like that, bullet points on it. It's quite clear that the Pakistani state only complied with about one of those demands over the course of the 20 years. That was allowing basically NATO to come and go from Afghanistan and resupply and move personnel and machinery and weaponry into Afghanistan. Basically, every other demand on that list, the Pakistani state either didn't comply with it at all or only half-heartedly complied with it in the initial sort of period post 9/11. And I think that that speaks to the broader American government failure here. One of the things that I've been testifying about and talking about on the podcast is that, you know, people are wondering, you know, why was Afghanistan such a debacle? I mean, there's a lot of reasons. I mean, we're not going to be able to summarize them all. But one of them is just the total lack of any kind of clear leadership over time. And I think the U.S. government made these demands under Colin Powell and Dick Armitage and never followed up on it, never really kept the pressure on the Pakistani state to comply with them. And so one of the things I told the Senate Banking Committee, for example, is that the U.S. provided more than $30 billion in military assistance and military reimbursements to the Pakistani state since 2001. And that clearly did not provide any sort of leverage for the U.S. over the Pakistanis when it came to harboring, facilitating, and supporting the Taliban and the Taliban senior leadership, including the Haqqani network. So, you know, when I made that argument for Senate Banking, I was trying to basically pop a bubble here. There's all this Washington speak, John, you know, about these different issues. And one of them is that we can have leverage over these different actors. And I just don't see it. But I come back to Colin Powell's original list of demands as a strong piece of evidence that America never really had leverage over the situation.
Let's go immediately to the Senate Banking Committee, because we're looking forward. You note in your conversation with Bill Raggio, and everyone can listen to these remarks on Generation Jihad, which is posted on the Longword Journal site. Senator Warren attended both of your testimonies to Armed Forces at Senate and to Banking at Senate, and she had a list of remarks, including quotes over the years, 20 years, of various officials in both parties, three governments, now four governments, Mr. Bush, Mr. Obama, Mr. Trump, and Mr. Biden, talking about turning the corner, turn this, turn that. And you make the dry remark, they turned so much they went back to the beginning. What is it that Senator Warren wanted to impress upon her colleagues in the Senate and the American people in these remarks, Tom?
I mean, basically, she and others are criticizing the U.S. military leadership. And I think, you know, from talking to Bill and me for so many years, John, that we've been critical as well of the generals and leadership, because, you know, when they were saying that they were turning the corner in Afghanistan, the phrase that they kept mindlessly repeating over and over again and Senator Warren brought up, you know, Bill and I were saying that wasn't the case, that, in fact, you know, my quip is that they turned the corner so much that they turned right back into the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. And we were saying all along the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan is coming back, and this doesn't really make any sense. So she's trying to that line of attack. And I think it's a legitimate line of attack. I mean, there's other things I don't agree with her on, but on this, I do agree. What I would say is that the problem I have is that I do think the U.S. military leadership failed here in many ways. I think that those failures took place within a political context. However, if you go through the history of the war in Afghanistan, there was ambivalence, really, from the senior political class, senior political leaders, really from the Oval Office on down, about how and even why and even whether, I should say, America should be fighting in Afghanistan. And so the military's leadership failed, but it failed in the context of broader political failures as well, I would say.
Turning to other remarks from the Senate Banking now, we're concentrating on that. The GOP you mentioned was keen on talking about the catastrophe of the withdrawal, the haphazardness, the rush, and the absence of forward thinking about maintaining Bagram as the point of exit and not the international airport at the center of Kabul that could not be protected, hence the catastrophe of the evacuation and the suicide bomber, however that happens. However, in the course of your remarks with your colleague Bill, what I learned is that even though there was chaos and withdrawal from the end, your measure is that the withdrawal didn't need to wait 3 months, that the Afghan government was always failing, and that there was no decent interval or whatever metaphor they used between when the president made the decision to leave and the actual leaving. It could have been done in an afternoon immediately after that and not wait for the Afghan government to fail. Was the Afghan government always going to fail, Tom? Did we build a government that could not succeed?
You know, I mean, counterfactuals are difficult, John. All I could say is the way this actually played out over time, going back many years, I think it was inevitable that it was going to fail. And I don't think that Bill and I ever came to a different conclusion or ever had a different prediction. Like to us, it was always a matter of when, not if. One of the things I would say here, and, you know, I had this exchange with Senator Warren. I don't think I was really as clear as I should have been really in explaining this, but she was talking about, you know, how, you know, basically withdrawing was the right decision and this and that. And I didn't necessarily really fully disagree with her. But part of what I was trying to say, if I were going to posit a counterfactual, one of the things America didn't do, and it's very curious, is that it basically held up Ashraf Ghani as the president of Afghanistan, held him in place even as senior political leaders and cabinet officials and others knew that Ghani was a failing president, that he couldn't actually hold his government together, and that he was going to fail. If I had to run it all over again, I was saying this at the time years ago to these same officials, you know, let the Afghans sort it out. Let them pick a leader. Let them fight for themselves. Figure out somebody that they want that maybe can be more of a brass knuckler than sort of a pseudo intellectual academic, which is what Ghani is and was. You know, in Afghanistan in particular, you want somebody who's a brawler who can maybe, you know, really fight it out, as opposed to somebody who is, you know, authoring specious books about saving failed states, which is what Ghani did prior to being president of Afghanistan. You know, so this is the conundrum here, or the real contradiction in the policy of America, was that America held this guy in place as the leader of Afghanistan, president of Afghanistan, even though everybody recognized he wasn't succeeding. It's totally bizarre. Now, that doesn't mean that if they had let them play it out and let somebody else replace him, that person would have succeeded or kept it together. But at least it would have given you some chance of that outcome, as opposed to what we thought was a 0% chance of anything positive coming.
I'm speaking with Tom Joslin of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He's a senior fellow. He and his colleagues keep the Long War Journal. We're focused especially on Tom's remarks with his colleague Bill Raggio on the podcast, reflecting upon Tom's testimony before the U.S. Senate within these last days, especially to the Banking Committee of the U.S. Senate. And when we come back, a commission to review the defeat in Afghanistan, a 20-year commission. Is it practical? What can it give us today that will help us into the future? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Tom Joslin of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He's a senior fellow. He and Bill Raggio and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal. Highly recommend to watch the chronology of the catastrophe in Afghanistan over many years, but now going forward. And in Tom's testimony recently to the Banking Commission, I believe it was Senator Duckworth of Illinois, who is asking in the direction of a commission, perhaps a congressional joint commission or a commission in the Senate only, to review the defeat, the failure, the mistakes of Afghanistan. Tom, your easy remark was that it's unlikely that you could be comprehensive. It is 20 years of making mistakes. But what would be worth reviewing, Tom, in such a commission, both militarily and in terms of the State Department's efforts?
You know, John, I think the way I've come to think about this stuff, and I don't think this is the only way you can address these matters, but I do think it's clarifying, is that, you know, I look now at history and even recent events as a series of decisions. People make decisions all the time. We make them in our personal lives, and we make them professionally, and you make them even in complex war fighting like the war in Afghanistan. And when I look back on the work that we've done, and you know, we're not perfect, obviously, but the thing that I think we got right that a lot of other people got wrong when it comes to the war in Afghanistan is that it was obvious to see that the decision that was being made was the wrong one at the time, if you just thought about it. And yet senior policymakers, political leaders, military officials made the wrong decision over and over again. And, you know, that to me, you know, it's not 2020 hindsight. We were saying at the time, you know, for example, yes, what, you know, how do you address the military and the diplomatic failures? I was recently looking through the Afghanistan Papers, this book by the Washington Post's Craig Whitlock. And, you know, there's some merit to the book and there's some merit to looking at the flawed decision making by U.S. military officials. But the book includes this odd idea that the U.S. could have just negotiated with the Taliban in late 2001 and all would have been well. And this is a completely farcical counterfactual. I mean, it's total nonsense. There's just abundant evidence that it was wrong. And it also ignores the fact that the U.S. basically spent 10 years just desperately pursuing a diplomatic solution with the Taliban. And so while the military track failed, the diplomatic track failed as well. And this speaks to the fact that people didn't really understand the Taliban or Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, didn't understand the enemy. And that flowed through to all these poor decisions that were made.
Diplomacy, the double track, the State Department and the Department of Defense working together or separately. In your conversation with Bill, you used a term, servile diplomacy, with regard to how the U.S. entreated the Taliban or its representatives. This was most obvious most recently in the negotiation in Doha. But did this go on for many years, Tom? Was the State Department always seeking to bend a knee to the Taliban to get them to comply with the U.S. wishes?
Yeah, I mean, if you go through the review the whole history of diplomacy here and compare it to sort of business dealings in the New York area. You know, John, I would imagine that a good number of your listeners are in the New York area. You know, if you know businessmen in the New York area or you've dealt with them in sort of economics and the finance world, and you look at how they do business dealings, you would see right away, if you were to compare the diplomacy of the Taliban to sort of the average business transaction in New York City, for example, that the party that was weak at the table was the American party all along. That in terms of negotiations, that the U.S. didn't know what it was doing and was really desperate to have any kind of deal with the Taliban. It's really kind of pathetic, to be honest with you. You know, if you go through the whole history, as I have, it was so pathetic that the U.S., even at the outset, gave $150,000 to a fake Taliban commander because they were desperate to find somebody to negotiate with. I mean, just picture this, John. This isn't the Taliban saying, hey, America, we want to talk, right? We want to have some kind of process for talking here, and we want to have some sort of diplomatic agreement here with you. This was America desperately trying to find somebody on the Taliban side to talk to. That's the first thing that tells you that America was weak here and it was servile diplomacy. And at first, they couldn't even find anybody who was a real representative of the Taliban to talk to. I mean, think about the ignorance there. They didn't even know who to actually reach out to. And they spent $150,000 to this. They spent this on this fake commander, Mullah Mansour, who wasn't really the real Mullah Mansour. And they gave him that money because they were trying to entice him into negotiations. And eventually, the irony, the twist here is that ultimately the U.S. actually ended up killing the real Mullah Mansour because he was a fully made al-Qaeda man who was loudly and proudly on al-Qaeda's side in the war and was rubbing America's nose in it. The bottom line is that I gave you that as one example from the history here, John. As you go through the diplomacy really from the 2010 era all the way through 2020, it is filled with examples like that of just completely servile, submissive diplomacy, and a total failure.
In your conversation, you named Senator Moran, asking about right now, does the U.S. have leverage or can the U.S. achieve leverage using diplomacy and, I guess, cash at the same time? Senator Moran is thinking in a direction of re-engaging with the Taliban. Is that how to hear his questions, Tom?
That seemed to be the implication to me, and it was kind of bizarre. Like I think he thought I gave him a non-answer. He said I gave him a non-answer to his question, but actually, I think I gave him the most pertinent answer that he could have gotten, to be honest with you, which was that, you know, his whole premise is that there, you know, the premise of negotiating with the Taliban or talking to the Taliban is that there is some reasonable basis for talks at this point. And and you have people in Washington saying the U.S. has leverage over the Taliban. This is diplo speak. This is sort of the mindless pabulum that you hear come out of Washington. And my point is, look, we have 25 years of history here, John. 25 years of history going back to 1996. You know the history as well as anybody because you've been doing this for so long and covering this, John, right? At any point in time, did the U.S. demonstrate that it had leverage over the Taliban? I mean, when, John, throughout our many talks about all this, throughout all of talking about this war and our conversations about all this on air, have we ever seen the U.S. have leverage over the Taliban? At no point in time has that been the case. And so I think that when the premise of what you want to do is based on such a faulty assumption as it is in this case, you have to question what it is you want to do. And I don't think that a lot of these guys really want to do that. I think they want to believe that there's some sort of humanitarian outcome here that is going to be acceptable and national security outcome here that would be acceptable. When the truth, as the title of our podcast says, is the emperor was new all along. America didn't really know what it was doing, and I don't think America knows what it's doing now.
I'm speaking with Tom Johnson, a senior fellow for the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He and Bill Raggio and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal. There's much to say about Tom's remarks with the Senate Banking Committee about what comes next. And when we come back, Pakistan also is their leverage. And the money in U.S. banks that is designated for the Afghan government, is that leverage? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
The This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Tom Joslin of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He's a senior fellow. He and his colleague Bill Raggio keep the Long War Journal, a chronicle of the vast canvas of the Ummah from the Mediterranean to the Hindu Kush and the battle with Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and now the Taliban, which is a subset of the larger war that we've witnessed for 20 years. However, in recent remarks before the Senate Banking Committee, Tom was asked Q&A about what happens next, observing, is there a way forward with the Taliban to help the Afghan people? For example, one version of what could come next is that the U.S. attempts to assist the Afghan people left behind in tatters, in great concern because they're under a regime that is non-transparent and bloody-minded. And the question came up about what leverage, what devices, what tools, what windows does the U.S. have? And Tom, I believe it turned to Pakistan. Pakistan is intimately involved with the success of the Taliban because the ISI, the state security forces in Pakistan, are acknowledged widely over many years. This isn't an issue where there's a debate. To sponsor, to support, to provide intelligence, and what should I say at this point, huzzas to the Taliban's success. Do we have a way in through Pakistan? And concomitantly, do we have a way in through the money that we're holding for the Taliban in the U.S.? Can we find in any fashion that they'd sit down with us because the money's useful?
You know, again, John, I think, you know, we have 25 years of experience here. And what we've learned is that money has not provided America or its allies leverage over the Taliban or Pakistan. That's the truth of the matter. When it came to fundamental issues, I mean, again, the Pakistani state cooperated somewhat in the initial period after 9/11, for sure. There are complex reasons for why that is, including fear of retaliation by the U.S. But, you know, I think that the broad experience here across 25 years is the U.S. didn't really know what it was doing and didn't at any point in time have leverage over these actors because it didn't really understand them. You know, and the thing is, you know, what's interesting about this, too, is that, you know, you hear it from State Department types talking about leverage. And yet the State Department's own reporting tells you that the U.S. never had any leverage over Pakistan in particular, because remember, it was the Trump administration in 2017 withheld military assistance and military reimbursements from the Pakistani state, you know, several hundred million dollars, and did so again in 2018. And yet the State Department noted that this did not change Pakistan's behavior when it came to sponsoring, harboring, and facilitating the Taliban and its senior leadership. So I think that the bottom line from my perspective is that, you know, I try and work in terms of evidence and what you can observe. And the observables here are all bad. At no point in time has the U.S. really understood what it's doing and doesn't really have any leverage over any of these actors. And it doesn't make any sense to go forward and pretend that it does. That to me is, I think, a message that a lot of people in Washington don't want to hear. They didn't want to hear me give it. But I think it's true. And I think, you know, that's the point of us saying the emperor was nude all along. Look, nobody knew what they were doing here.
The money is also being offered by our adversaries and people states that we could say are not our allies. That would be China, Russia, Iran, even Pakistan is talking about aiding the Taliban. Is it wise for us to step away from the table? Is it tactically useful and watch our adversaries provide aid and gain access to Kabul?
Yeah, I mean, the point that Bill and I have made is that if these actors want to recognize, you know, they've enabled or in some cases sponsored the Taliban's Islamic Emirate and helped the Taliban resurrect it for all these years, if they want to continue to do business with them and they want to sponsor them, then that's nothing. The U.S. doesn't really have the ability to do much about that other than, you know, pretend, you know, erect more sanctions or enforce sanctions, something like that. But what it does is it lessens, I don't think there's any reason to think America has any leverage over the Taliban. But, you know, the leverage theory is that the U.S. can do business with the Taliban because they need this money. Well, my point is that they have these other sources of money and they are all adversaries of the U.S. or enemies, or in some cases outright enemies of the U.S. And so that that's another example of how there are these avenues which the U.S. does not control and does not have any leverage over. And the idea that the U.S. could somehow exercise leverage in this environment seems fanciful to me.
The $9 billion or $7.5 billion, depending upon the reporting, that is in U.S. banks. Is your sense, Tom, that the State Department is looking to release that money, saying that it'll go to aid the Afghan people who are facing a difficult winter without the support that the U.S. and its allies have provided? Do you think that money's going to the Taliban?
You know, so far I haven't seen any firm indications that that was the case. I mean, obviously the Taliban wants the money. You can see on their social media accounts are agitating for it. You know, part of what I've talked about here too are two things. One, obviously money's fungible. So if the U.S. is going to talk about providing humanitarian aid to Afghans, then it should be kind of in-kind or hard goods, you know, food, medicine, that sort of thing, not money or anything that can be easily converted into money. Because the point is that money can be used for multiple things. And so to provide them with hard cash, there's no guarantee that they're going to use that on humanitarian purposes. And when you provide them with hard cash, what that does is it means that they can use less of their resources on other things. So if I have $2 and I want to spend $1 on humanitarian aid and $1 on terrorism or my authoritarian regime sort of enforcing its Sharia rule in Afghanistan, and you give me $1 for humanitarian aid, well, now I have $2 for my nefarious purposes, right? So that's why, you know, when it comes to hard cash or any kind of monetary assistance, it doesn't make any sense. And I think at the Senate banking hearing, that certainly I didn't hear anybody talking about releasing the funds outright to them.
Turning the story around, does the Taliban have leverage over the U.S.? There are, depending upon your source of information, a great number of people and families and vulnerable people left behind who seek exit. Some of them might be long-time threats, threatened by the Taliban and are in hiding. I hear stories, Tom. I don't know what it comes to. But in any event, that would be a way of converting that cash that's in U.S. banks into doing good for people. Do you think that's credible, to buy the hostages that the Taliban is holding?
I mean, look, the U.S. State Department announced $64 million in humanitarian aid to the Taliban's regime, just in the weeks after they took over the country. What was that $64 million for? You know, what are the terms of it? I mean, they try and discuss it in pure humanitarian terms. But, you know, was there a quid pro quo? Was there some sort of haggling involved there? I mean, I don't know, but I would ask that question if I were a lawmaker, for sure, because, you know, I'd want to know why it is that the U.S. is so eager to give this money to the Taliban. I mean, I'm sure that they're trying to extract more cash payments, and they are using, as you say, John, they are using Americans trapped in Afghanistan as leverage over us. And so I wouldn't doubt that they're seeking more financial aid under the auspices of humanitarian assistance when it's really some sort of quid pro quo.
Bill's idea was using NGOs to help the Afghan people. But I understand there was a member of the Afghan parliament who testified on the same time you, a young woman, I believe, who recommended not providing money. Did I hear that correct, Tom?
Well, that's Naheed Farid, who was a member of the Afghan parliament. And she actually made the recommendation of working with NGOs, which, if that's possible and the Taliban will allow it and the Taliban doesn't exercise control of it, sure. My warning here is that the Taliban's Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan is an authoritarian regime. I don't see how they're going to allow any independent channels to operate in Afghanistan. You know, I think it was Senator Toomey asked me at one point, would the Afghan Taliban allow the UN to have a peacekeeping force in Afghanistan to sort of monitor and control and dispense humanitarian assistance? I don't see any way the Taliban's going to allow that. I mean, the Taliban rejects UN peacekeeping forces and is openly adversarial with respect to the UN and various parts of it. So I don't see how they're going to allow any kind of foreign troop presence in Afghanistan when that's really what they were agitating against all along.
So what we've come to, Tom, and Bill's remark at one time in your conversation is that the wise course now is to stand back and do nothing and watch as the Taliban develops. Is that I know that's not something to do, but is it possible that's where we are, Tom, because all the other choices are not attractive?
Yeah, I think disengaging, doing nothing other than monitoring security threats or, you know, just playing at the margins is always an option. I think one of the problems with Washington policymaking elites is that they always think that there has to be some answer, there has to be something to do. But that sort of phony thinking guided numerous wrongheaded decisions over 20 years in Afghanistan. Sometimes there's nothing you can do because people don't understand it. And part of that's, again, I know I keep saying this, but that's why the point of my testimony was, folks, the emperor is nude. The emperor was nude all along. You can't pretend that the emperor is clothed now, that the emperor knows what it's doing, because he doesn't. And that's always been the point when it comes to the Afghan war. So, I don't think that any – I think that a lot of the sort of diplomats or international aid people are going to want to dress this up as they know best and that they know how to deal with the Taliban, and I just wouldn't buy it.
Tom Jocelyn, Senior Fellow, Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He and Bill Raggio and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal. Tom and Bill also have Generation Jihad, and I'm basing my remarks on their most recent podcast. However, there is the matter of what is going on in Afghanistan that we can see from the outside. And when we come back, ISIS, if that is the case, and also Al-Qaeda, that is the case. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Tom Jocelyn. He and Bill Raggio and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal. We turn to Afghanistan, what we can see from the outside. Tom's testimony to the Banking Commission looked forward. Well, forward includes a suicide attack. I'm watching the CNN reporting from some days past. A suicide attack at the largest Shia mosque in the southern Afghan city of Kandahar killed 32 people, injured at least 68 more. This, according to the government-owned Bakhtar News Agency, in other words, the Taliban. CNN goes on to say the second week running that an attack has targeted Friday prayers at a Shia mosque. The majority of Afghans practice Sunni Islam. Tom, this is not just the second ISIS attack. We talked about ISIS attacking a convoy some weeks ago in Jalalabad. So if I look at the map of Afghanistan, Jalalabad in the east, Kandahar in the center, Kandahar in the south, and Kunduz in the northeast, the ISIS is demonstrating an ability to attack and not be stopped by the severe reaction of the Taliban forces. Is this significant in any fashion, Tom, to what we can imagine comes next for Afghanistan and the region?
You know, I think it's significant for a couple of reasons. I mean, one, obviously, is that geographic footprint illustrates, as you say, John, it shows that ISIS is still operating in different hotspots throughout Afghanistan. It's not just in one area. I would make the point, though, that, you know, the attacks on the Taliban convoys in Jalalabad that we talked about a few weeks back, those were improvised explosive device attacks. They were sort of low sophistication. They did actually do some damage and kill a number of Taliban figures and fighters. So it was successful in that regard. These other two attacks, however, are suicide bombings at Shiite mosques. These are civilian mosques. There's low security on them. And these are sort of easy targets. You know, they're not really hardened targets. They're not really showing any kind of operational sophistication in pulling them off. The real point of them is more of a political message within the jihadi world. And that political message is that the Taliban, according to ISIS, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda are not being strict enough in enforcing their Sunni Sharia, their Islamic law, on the Shiites of Afghanistan. And in fact, according to ISIS, the Sunni jihadists have the right to spill the blood of Shiites at any point in time, whenever they care to. And so this has been a longstanding ISIS critique of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, that they sort of take it easy on Shiites. And so this is why they're going after the ethnic minority, the Hazaras of Afghanistan, who are Shiites. They're going after them to make this play inside this jihadi rivalry. You know, the other thing about the attack in Kunduz, John, is that the ISIS very quickly identified the suicide bomber as a Uyghur. That is, you know, someone whose origins are in the Xinjiang province of the western province of China. And they very quickly, the Islamic State said that the reason why he did this, the suicide bomber did this at the Shiite mosque in Kunduz, was that the Taliban has promised to expel Uyghurs and not let them go after China and Chinese interests and Chinese personnel inside China or inside Xinjiang. And so the ISIS message was effectively to the Taliban and to Uyghur jihadists who have been allied with the Taliban and al-Qaeda for so many years, look, you can come join us and this will we're not going to rein you in. We're going to give you an opportunity to go kill people.
Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is a larger story, and I'm going to just focus on your conversation with Bill and the Taliban in Pakistan, the TTP. If I heard correctly, this is a loose confederation. It is nowhere near central commanded the way the Afghan Taliban is. However, it has many elements that are suggestive that the Al-Qaeda is influencing the TTP, which is directed against the Pakistan government. Does that have significance for the people of Afghanistan? I understand it does for Pakistan, that Al-Qaeda is operating, what you'd have to say, without trying to disguise its relationship with TTP.
Yeah, I mean, the TTP has always acted as sort of a cutout for Al-Qaeda. You know, I don't think it's had 100% control of the TTP across its history, but it's had large influence and exercised control at times for sure. And I think that there's firm evidence that Al-Qaeda has had a say in the leadership of the TTP and who that overall leader is. And the TTP itself has sort of saluted the flag and saluted Al-Qaeda at various times to show that it's part of the Al-Qaeda web. Its current leader is a guy named Noor Wali Massoud, who's from the Massoud tribe in northern Pakistan. There's a lot of evidence this bill has accumulated and I've accumulated that he is bringing the TTP coalition back together. Now, remember, the Pakistani Taliban, in addition to the attacks in Pakistan, a big part of what it's done is it helped the Afghan Taliban resurrect its Islamic Emirate. So it's going to be very tough for the Afghan Taliban at this point to turn on them and betray them somehow. And in fact, there's a lot of overlap between the two. You know, the Haqqani Network, which we've talked about on your show multiple times, John, which is an integral part of the Taliban, also helped build and sponsor and provide safe haven for the Pakistani Taliban. And so you have a guy like Sirajuddin Haqqani, who's the interior minister of the new Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, which is really just the old Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. You know, he's been in bed with the Pakistani Taliban since its inception, really, for many years. So this isn't a case of sort of these are two different mutually exclusive parties, which is the way some people frame it. There's significant overlap there.
The Al-Qaeda relationship with the Taliban. The Al-Qaeda statements making threats, we've covered them already on the Long War Journal. I am asking, did the Senate Banking Committee or the Armed Forces Committee, did they ask questions that suggested that they're aware that the Al-Qaeda never left Afghanistan and that it is now a staging area for Al-Qaeda, a safe haven? Did they ask questions in that direction, Tom?
You know, I don't think anybody... you remember President Biden slipped up several weeks ago. I think it was in the end of August, August 31st, when he claimed that Al-Qaeda was gone from Afghanistan. And that obviously was false, you know, and I don't think anybody actually argues that. No, nobody at either one of these hearings was arguing that. However, I don't think they really understand that it wasn't a matter of Al-Qaeda coming back to Afghanistan. I think some personnel, some leaders will. I think some fighters will. But I think what people missed is that Al-Qaeda was there all along and Al-Qaeda helped the Taliban win the war. You know, one of these phony distinctions that you'll hear, John, you're going to continue here, and this is one of the real mistakes in all this, is this idea that the Taliban is just this purely nationalist jihadist group and movement, whereas Al-Qaeda and ISIS are transnational. And this is a phony distinction because Al-Qaeda itself is a local jihadist organization in many places. They play the local game, the national game when it comes to Afghanistan. In other words, they played a big role in winning the war in Afghanistan. And meanwhile, parts of the Taliban, including key leaders, have repeatedly endorsed Al-Qaeda's transnational agenda. I mean, it's not the case that they are only looking at inside Afghanistan. But this goes to show that this enemy was never understood, really, amongst the U.S. elite.
And here we are, Tom, the end of 2021, and Afghanistan is lost to transparency. Going forward, we just have about a minute. What is a question you want answered as we get what we can out of Afghanistan? A question about the Taliban's credibility. What do you want to know, Tom?
There's not really much that I want to know. I mean, obviously, there's a lot that we're not going to know going forward. What I would say is, if I had one thing I'd want to know is, you know, why is the U.S. government keep allowing the Taliban to lie about everything and not calling them on it? You know, one of the issues here, one of the reasons why we knew this war was lost was that some years ago, the Taliban would just so obviously lie about matters, like say that Al-Qaeda is not even present in Afghanistan. And there's nobody on the American side who would even bother to rebut that point. That shows you the failures in leadership here, too. And I don't know why going forward, America has any interest in allowing the Taliban to continue lying and engaging the Taliban as it lies without calling them out on it or doing something about it.
Tom Johnson, a senior fellow for the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. He and his colleague Bill Raggio and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal. Tom and Bill also do Generation Jihad. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.